This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we're going to talk to a New York Times best-selling author. His name is Linwood Barclay, and he's here to talk about the third book in his Promise Falls trilogy called The 23. Hello!
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi. This is the first time you've written a trilogy.
It is. Probably the last, too.
Wait a minute, why? This is the best trilogy I've read in years.
It was fun to do, but it just about killed me because I felt that when I decided to write three connected novels, I was very concerned that I would get to the third one and think of something that I should have introduced and set up in the first. So I wrote them back to back. They were all three novels in 15 months. And that's the part that almost killed me. And it's just like kind of the way I work. I just would feel I have to do them. So if I were ever going to do it again, I would probably do it the same way. And doing them that way, cranking them out one after the other, was just really exhausting. It just kind of really wrung me out. So I don't know if I would do that specifically again. I mean, it's sort of a continuing story is one thing, but three books that are very much linked together in plot is another thing altogether. So I'm not sure if I would do it. The other aspect of it is some readers were kind of, I think, confused by it because the publishers had different feelings about how much to sort of telegraph that they were part of it, that it was a trilogy, because they thought, well, if we tell them it's a trilogy, nobody will buy it until book three is out or this and that. So there were those kind of issues, too, that were part of it. Like someone would email and say, well, I really liked the second book, but I got to the end and it's not resolved. And I'd say, well, it's a trilogy. Well, and they'd say, well, I didn't know that. So there are a lot of issues connected to it. I mean, I'm very happy with it. I mean, I think it's a nice body of work, the three of them together. And now that all three are out, with the 23 out, and, you know, if anyone now wants to binge the whole thing and they don't have to wait, they can do it.
Exactly. Now, we should mention it comes out on November 1st, which is very close to the day we're talking now, but just a couple of weeks. But, yeah, this is the best trilogy I've read in years. I really immensely enjoyed this. And it's one of those trilogies you can just sit and enjoy. It's a great trilogy to take to the beach or to take somewhere on vacation and just sit and enjoy, because you have a remarkable gift for characters.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And having read a lot of books, I can tell you that a lot of times I don't feel like I know the characters well enough. But you get so much into these characters, David and Duckworth and all the relatives and even the hoarder. And you just feel like you know these characters so well. Even after book one, you just feel a real closeness with these characters, like the people you might even know yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, and that's gratifying. I'm glad you enjoyed it, because I can say I had kind of a blast writing it, and in many ways I couldn't wait to get to book three, because there's, you know, this backstory that builds through books one and two, and it's what explodes in book three.
Right.
And I always knew how kind of book three was at least how it was going to open. And so I couldn't wait to get to. So I had to write two other books and get them out of the way before I could get to the one I really couldn't wait to do.
I mean, what a great start! 23 dead squirrels. You know, it's like who's ever started a book like that before?
Well, yeah, that's book one. Book one is 23 dead squirrels. All these bizarre incidents with 23.
I can imagine what kind of mail you've gotten after you put book one out. Like, when are you going to tell us what the 23 squirrels mean?
Oh, I know. I've had lots of those. When, you know, I had an email from a woman yesterday. She said, "Well, I'm just not going to read the third book. Can you just tell me what the 23 means?"
I hope you said no.
I said no.
That's funny. That's funny. And I can understand the frustration, but half the fun of reading a full story, and even if it's in three books, is playing it out and trying to figure it out for yourself and trying to figure out what's going on and what that 23 means. And I can have vivid pictures of some of the scenes in this book. I don't want to tell too many because I'll give some stuff away, but especially the scene at the movie theater is just, you know, amazing.
Yeah, book two. That's the opening for book two in Far From True is the The drive-in theater, yeah, that's a kind of a calamitous event.
And I'm not so sure. When I saw it was a trilogy, I thought, oh boy, I have to read three in a row. I have never enjoyed reading three books before in my life. I mean, it was just really tremendous, Linwood. And you know what? I don't say that about a lot of books. And I've read, I can tell you right now, I didn't finish the Hunger Games trilogy. So I never read book three, and I still haven't read it.
Well, let's hope this does even a fraction as well as the Hunger Games trilogy.
But the thing is, yeah, exactly. The thing is, if it's going to be a trilogy, it has to be good. You have to hook that reader. And after the first book, you're more than hooked. You just can't wait for the second book. And I went right from book one to book two.
And, you know, I think book two is often the toughest one in a trilogy because you really are kind of bridging. You know, you've set them everything up in book one, and you're waiting for the big payoff in book three. And so book two can be tricky. But I think I managed to create enough of a standalone story in book two so that, you know, it doesn't fall into that trap.
Yeah, you did a remarkable job with the characters. And the way that you read the book and you can't wait to see how the characters are going to interact with each other, it's such a wonderful thing. You know, to be able to experience that in a book, you know, and you're like, oh boy, I can't wait to see what these two are going to do with each other. You know, it's really so enjoyable.
Great.
And, you know, and I'm not just saying that because I'm interviewing. I really, really felt that way. And,
yeah.
And to be able to tell the author that you're feeling that way is amazing. It's an amazing thrill for me. But you talked about how tough they were to write because you had to write them so close together. But where did this idea come from?
Well, it really goes back to a discussion with my agent. It must be at least 4 years ago now. We talked about whether it would be interesting to do three books that were connected. And so the first thing I had to think about was, okay, that's why I want to set out and do that, but what I had to think about was the big picture. I had to do what's the sort of overarching story for the whole thing. And once I had that in mind, then I could focus more on, well, what's the sort of standalone story within the first book, and then the standalone story within the second. And I'd had an idea floating around in my head for a while about a story that involved an infant, about a baby, and that baby story is really what takes up most of that's what most of book one, Broken Promise, is about. And so I got that, you know, once I got that under my belt, then I thought, well, book two, what's going to go on there? And I thought about a house with a secret room where there's all kinds of shenanigans going on and so forth. And I thought, I can use all of these storylines and then I can find a way to weave them into the overall story that involves the number 23.
And that's not easy. I mean, what you're talking about doing is not easy work.
Well, it wasn't. And, you know, but the funny thing was, I thought, because I generally do, I have a book that would come out every 12 months. And I thought, well, this is great. I've managed to write all three of them in 15 months. I can put my feet up on the desk for like 2 years. And then my publisher said, well, this is great. They're all finished. Why don't we tighten up the release date and we'll bring all of them out within a year and a half? So there went all that free time.
Suddenly you lost a lot of months in there. Wait, what happened to my free time?
I know.
But look what came out as a result. I mean, some tremendous reading. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
And I can only, if you're out there and you have book clubs, you got to read these for your book clubs because you'll really, and even if it's three and you're cheating, I know you usually only read one, but you have to read all three, but
you know,
you're going to love it.
My wife tends to read the books, my novels, when they're in the like the advanced reader copy edition, the advanced.
Oh, lucky her!
That go out to people like you and book reviewers. So she waits until they're all done. But when I gave her the advanced copy of the first one, she said, "I have to have the second one now." And of course, I had it just in the computer, and so I let her. So I had her read it then, and then when she finished that, about a day later, she said, "I absolutely must have the third one now." So she got to read all three of them, you know, within about a week.
Did she ask you for a little preview of how it was going to end, or did she play it out?
She was just able to read them all one after the other, so she didn't go out.
That's great. But the gap between when she read the second one and the third one, how long of a gap was that?
Between when...
When she read the second one...
Like the next day. Written.
So it wasn't...
At that point, I had them all written. So she was able to go right into the next one.
Oh,
so,
lucky her. Good heavens.
I know. She got lucky. I have a very good friend in Toronto who sometimes reads. I give him my stuff to sort of bounce it off him, and I gave him all three. to read one after the other, and he was just loving it. Now, I mean, obviously he didn't end up reading the final copies, the final versions, because, you know, they were changes in Dictionary Book 3.
Right.
But you got the gist of it.
It's amazing. You're right, and it's like eating popcorn. You just can't stop once you start this story. It's just... It's like a big spider web, and then you suddenly realize everything's connected, and wow, and all the characters are so incredibly realistic. And, you know, do you have a hoarder in your family or know somebody who's a hoarder?
No. No, in fact, we're always throwing out stuff. we have known people like that, you know, but not within the family. I mean, we're always sort of going through, why do we still have this? And we throw it out. And it's funny, my university that I went to was interested in, you know, possibly someday having like a little sort of archive of all of my stuff. And I said, well, every time I finish anything and I have rough copies of stuff, I just throw it all in the garbage. And they were like, no, don't do that. But
right.
So, and everybody, you know, we moved 5 years ago, and even then we just sort of went through everything and got rid of stuff. So we don't fall into that category.
Right. But this is the best stuff of yours I've read, as much as I've read of yours. This is the best that I've liked of anything you've ever written. And I think that's remarkable. And I've read some of your other stuff, which I did indeed like. In fact, I can't remember anything of yours I haven't liked when I've read it.
Well, I think it's in some ways the best thing I've done, just because it encompasses so much, because it has a much broader scope, because it is three books that are connected. I mean, I think some of my favorite, but my own personal favorite book that I've ever done was a book called Trust Your Eyes, which I think is still my favorite, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily a reader's favorite. And I think, you know, I think people are going to enjoy these three connected books, especially now that they're, you know, that we're just about to the point where they can get all three of them at once.
Well, you make it sound like you write for the readers, or do you write for yourself? Who are you writing for?
Well, it's both, you know. I mean, I want to entertain, and I guess the first person I have to entertain is me. So if I'm writing it and it feels like it's getting boring or it's getting repetitive, then I think, well, this is not going to work. This isn't going to do. I mean, if it doesn't maintain my interest, it's sure not going to maintain a reader's. So in that sense, I'm the first guy who has to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if I am and I'm having fun writing it, then I think that's the first step in having readers entertained.
Exactly. Because I've interviewed authors before, and they'll tell me that they write for themselves, and I always think, oh, well, that's interesting. I wonder if they write with the intent that it's challenging to them. It's something that they would want to read if they were going to read something.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think also when you're writing a book, you're always thinking, how can I make this better than any other book I've done? And there's always this, you're always kind of competing with yourself. You think, how can I outdo the last one? And sometimes you feel you've done it, sometimes you don't. You feel you didn't. But that's, I think, always the goal, is trying to write that perfect book.
Now, how many people do you imagine live in Promise Falls?
Oh, I think I figured it out one time, and then it varies. But I think it's really like more like a small city. But I think we're looking at about 40,000 people or so.
40,000, wow.
I think it's around that. I mean, it could be somewhere between 30 and 40, I think, is what it probably is. I imagine it sometimes based on a town where I worked at a newspaper there and went to university in a place called Peterborough, Ontario. And I often picture Peterborough as Promise Falls, although I think Promise Falls is smaller. But it's small enough that, you know, if people run into each other, it doesn't seem like an unbelievable coincidence. It's not like two people just bumping into each other in Manhattan. That's kind of really. But in Promise Falls, it's believable because it's small enough that it's this contained unit. It's like an island in its own way.
Now, you had a fierce battle of one of your books for being a movie.
Well, yeah, and a few years ago, when Trust Your Eyes came out, we had a bidding war between Universal and Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers got it. And they had it, they had assigned the director, they assigned, I've forgotten the name all of a sudden, but they were set to go, they had a director, they assigned a screenwriter, the whole thing. And they had it for 2 years in development, and then it died. As so many of these things just do. And so if anyone's listening, that book is currently available, Trust Your Eyes.
Really? But, so it never did get filmed?
Never got filmed. Well, I think Hollywood, of every 100 things it options, maybe one thing gets made.
Yeah.
But so I didn't get made. We had some people asking around about the trilogy just now, but we haven't had an actual offer yet. The one thing that did happen is in France, a novel I did a few years ago called The Accident has been turned into a 6-part TV series.
Oh, that's a good book. I've read that one.
Yeah, and that's all filmed. It's all set to go. They invited us over towards the end of back in April, and we went over for the shoot. Part of the shoot as it wrapped up and did interviews and stuff like that. I think it's not going to air. It's like it was filmed in French for the French TV, although I've seen the first two episodes subtitled, and they've done a very nice job on it. I think it's going to air over there in the spring.
Right.
So my hope is that it'll end up on Netflix or something with subtitles at some point.
Oh, cool. Just like Harlan Coben when his Tell No One was filmed over.
Yeah, he's huge over there. And France is one of my best markets, but Harlan's huge in France.
It's amazing, you know. You wonder why these certain countries fall in love with authors so much, and why one over the other, and it's fascinating.
I know it's bizarre. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, my single best market is England, the UK. I do better there than anywhere else.
Really?
But yet I do well in a lot of places all over the world, but England is huge for me. And so it's funny, and yet, you know, there'll be other people who are just absolutely huge in the U.S., and then in France, I do better than they do. It's very odd.
Is it, you have to sign a different contract for every country? Is that how it works?
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow, yeah. That's a lot of signing.
Well, you know, I mean, thankfully we have, you know, you have people who prepare all that paperwork and so forth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Scribble on them, but I mean, for example, a French contract will cover not only France, but any other French-speaking nations, and they'll also even have the right to sell that book in Canada, where I am in Quebec, in, you know, French-language editions. So, but yeah, you end up signing an awful lot of different contracts with a lot of different publishers, but at least you don't have to translate them. That would be a bit much.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the beauty of it. You have to just write the books. That's all you have to do. That's easy, but it's what you do best.
And people will say, well, how do you know if the translations are good? Well, I don't. You know, there's some things you just have to take on faith. There's nothing you can do about them.
Yeah, and it's true, because I've read some translations that weren't quite what I wanted them to be. And you can just tell they were forced into being translated, and they don't flow real nicely.
Yeah, well, if they do it with Google Translate, it's not going to work.
were any of the three books more difficult than any of the others?
Right. Good question. I think I think they all came out relatively easily, but I think the second one would probably be the trickiest because as I said, it's this bridging book. And so you want to keep the backstory alive without giving it away, and you want a self-contained story as well. So, I mean, I think that's the trickiest one. The third one, I think, was the easiest to write. It was and probably the most fun.
And then you can wrap up all the things you need to wrap up.
Oh, yeah. We thought there's all these payoffs coming, and so that was a lot of fun to do, the 23.
I can just picture all the people waiting at the bookstore. When's it coming out?
I know. I was in a bookstore up here in Canada the other day, and they recognized me, and I said, we've had a lot of people asking about the third one. When's it coming? Well, it's November 1st. It's soon.
Wow, and it must be nice to be able to tell them that. You don't have to worry about saying, well, when I, like George Martin, you know, is George Martin ever going to finish his book?
Oh, I know.
You can imagine the pressure that man is under. Like,
I know.
You got to finish it. Well, his are thousands of pages, though, like that, over,
I know.
Probably over 1,000. But, you know, and it's not easier to write a 1,000-page book.
No, it's got to be really brutal to do that.
But your three books together are, I think, over almost 1,000 pages, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Each one is closing in on 500, so it's 400 to 500 pages.
But it's amazing how quickly the story goes. It moves very quickly, and there's no point where they ever become boring. It's amazing. They just flow so nicely. One thing that happens flows into another. And the way you juggle all the different storylines is really well done.
Well, that's kind of what I aimed to do, was to always be kind of rotating from this set of characters to this set of characters, and then because there was a lot of different storylines going on, we would rotate through all of them, and then we get back to that one that we were at like 4 chapters ago, which allowed you to kind of build all these little cliffhangers into the end of every chapter. You have a little something ends with 6 were off to something else. You got to wait till chapter 7 to get back to find out what happened with David. And I think that adds to the sense of kind of the rush of the book, because you're racing through it thinking, well, I got to get back to that story. But in the meantime, I got to get back to all those other stories that were happening in the interim. And so it builds that sense of momentum.
Yeah, David's kind of like the voice of reason. He's the normal, everyday, all-American guy who we root for. We want...
Yeah.
He loses his job at the very beginning of the first book, and you know, what's he going to do? How's he going to support his young son?
Yeah, he has a rough go of it. He's had a lot of bad things happen to him. I mean, he's the subject of my earlier book called Never Look Away, and bad things happened to him in that one too.
Oh, he's in another book.
He's in another book because there's references in.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In Broken Promise to his wife, who's no longer with him. And that, in fact, is the subject of the novel Never Look Away.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm not sure if I read
that. That's okay. Like, I tried to just kind of breeze over that part, you know, and move past it. But for those who have read Never Look Away, they'll read the new one and think, oh, yeah, I know what happened to his wife.
Oh, interesting.
But that's an earlier story.
And when was that? That was written a number of years ago, wasn't it?
That's about 6 years ago, that book.
Wow.
Yeah. But there's a lot of characters from earlier novels that show up in the trilogy, like Randall Finley appears in my novel Too Close to Home. David's in Never Look Away. Duckworth is in both of those novels. So there's a lot of recurring characters.
So you're getting to be like Stephen King with a different.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen King has everything relates to Maine or something.
That's right. Derry. Bad things happen in Derry.
Exactly. Derry. I mean, it's just. And Stephen King likes your book, actually. I've read that somewhere.
Yeah, he claims to be a big fan. Like, he loved Trust Your Eyes. First, I found out he was writing in Entertainment Weekly one time, and just out of the blue mentioned Never Look Away, and then The Accident. And he tweeted about Far From True, that he really liked it. So he seems to be a bit of a fan. In fact, I've even made it into a couple of his books. I mean, in The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, there's a character who's reading the latest one with Barclay. And in fact, when I did Trust Your Eyes has a made-up website that's based on Google Street View called World 360. World 360 shows up in Dr. Sleep. Some bad people are using it to try to find somebody on the net.
And, oh, wow.
That's kind of cool. But I've got to. I met him briefly a couple years ago, and that was around the time of the World 360 thing. He says, "Did you catch the reference?" And I went, "Oh yes." That was very. It was kind of fun. Very
that
nice
is
guy.
Cool. Yeah. To think of all the books he could be reading, and he's reading yours, is kind of overwhelming.
It's kind of mind-boggling. Yeah, it is. It kind of is.
You're like, well, who else? Because you know he reads a lot, but even he's very discriminatory as far as what he likes, too.
Very, very just voracious reader.
And if you don't hear him mention your name, you know, he just probably doesn't like your book or hasn't read it.
Yeah.
you're just so good with characters and good with the story, and it's so vitally important. You have to have a good character. You have to tell a good story. You have to have something that hooks the reader into the story. And you do it so nicely, and it is just amazing. I mean, when I think of books today I've written, I just was reading one, and it was very slow in the beginning, and I thought, I'm not sure I'm going to like this book. And then as I got into it, I liked it more. But I'm thinking, I've always had these questions about the beginnings of books, because a lot of times the beginnings of books are not always that good.
Well, I don't think you've got a lot of time to get readers' attention. I mean... You know, as a writer, we're not just competing against other writers' books. We're competing against fabulous television. Like, the best TV that's ever been made is being made now. We're competing against people just killing time on their phone. I mean, we're up against so many other things now. I think you have to grab readers' attention really quickly.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think, well, you think of some books, I mean, there's 700-page books coming out now, and it's like, how in the world do you get people interested in a 700-page book unless it's really that great?
Yeah. I don't know. I think you have to grab them by the lapels, you know, really fast and just...
Something happened. Dick Francis used to say he used to kill somebody on every, like, the first page of every one of his books.
Yeah.
Is that what you have to do to hook readers?
Well, I don't know if you have to kill them that fast, but you got to do something. You got to find a way to get their attention. I think this is true of literary agents. Literary agents get sent mountains of manuscripts every week, and I think that a lot of the agents look at everything, but they don't look at it for long. They look at that first page and they think, can this person write or can they not? And they make a very quick decision, and I think that's what readers do too.
That's a shame that happens, but I guess it, maybe it's for the best, I guess. But I mean, there's still a lot of really good readers, writers out there who don't get noticed or you don't hear about too much.
It's true. That's very true.
And it's sad if they know what they're doing. And but then you pick up another book and you think, I can't read this book. How did it get published?
Yeah. I know.
And you just can't figure out any rhyme or reason to anything. Sometimes it's just, you know, I don't understand publishing. Now, you were actually born in the United States, but you pretty much lived in Canada a long time, right?
Yeah, my parents, was born in Connecticut, and my parents moved to Canada just before I turned 4. My dad worked in advertising. He was a commercial illustrator, and he was offered a job at a firm in Toronto, and he took it. So I've been in Canada since the age of 3.
Interesting. You never had the urge to go back to the United States and live?
No, and there hasn't really been a reason or an opportunity. I mean, I grew up here. I went to school here. I got a newspaper job. I mean, jobs in newspapers here, and so it just never even presented itself as an opportunity. And I like it here. You know, I mean, I love the U.S. too. I go down there a lot, and I, you know, I'm a dual citizen. I have 2 passports and so forth. And we like it here. Except for the winter, it's a bit chilly at times.
Yeah, well, it's no different here. They're already saying how horrific the winter's going to be, and I'm sitting here and it's like 80 degrees today.
I know.
I'm thinking, and are you sure the winter's going to be that bad? Did you read a lot of would you have read The Girl on the Train and all the books that are...
There's a lot of stuff that I have not read, and a lot of times I don't always read the kind of stuff that I write.
Are you afraid that something might rub off and you might actually...
No, it's just that, you know, I think, well, that's what I do. When I read, I'll do something different. And so, I do read a lot of crime fiction, but I think I read stuff that you might not call thrillers. I mean, I read stuff that's very heavy on character. And so, I mean, I read, love George Pelicanos, and I love James Lee Burke, and I love, you know, Carl Hiaasen, I actually interviewed when he was in Toronto here a few weeks ago. And
oh, wow.
So I read a lot of that. A lot of stuff that maybe isn't even in the category of what I write, and you know, the odd, you know, if Philip Roth were still writing, I'd read his stuff when it came out. And so it's not, I don't tend to read exactly the kind of thing that I write.
Exactly. Well, everybody's different, and every author tells me something different. Some will tell me, "Well, no, I read everything I can get my hands on," or, you know,
yeah.
You wonder when they have the time.
Well, I'm in the thick of writing a book right now, and so I'm not, I'm trying to read, but I'm not getting very much read.
You imagine Nora Roberts doesn't have time to read other people's books.
You wouldn't think, no. Not when she's doing one every 2 weeks.
Working 70 hours a week, if she does indeed work that many hours, I mean, you wouldn't have any other time to... But what is it about writing? I mean, it seems like lately it's like an addiction with writers. Once they get started on a book, they just can't stop. They just keep... I mean, Stephen King said he was going to retire years ago, and he's still writing.
I just think it's, we don't know what else we would do with ourselves. I mean, every once in a while I talk about, well, gee, would I want to retire?
But it's a lot of hard work too, though, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's compulsion. I mean, you know, look at musicians, look at artists, look at anybody who's doing anything creative. They just keep doing it. I mean, can you picture, like, is Bob Dylan going to retire? Is, you know, do singers retire? I mean, unless they lose their voice. They just keep doing what they do. And I think not to denigrate any other kind of profession, but I mean, is being a plumber an obsession? Is working in a bank an obsession? I think those are jobs, and I think that writing and art are kind of obsessions, and we're obsessed with doing it, and so we just don't know what else we could do with ourselves. So,
have you had anything in your life that's been as obsessive as writing?
No, nothing. I don't think so. Every once in a while I talk about, well, I write, you know, I've got a contract to do 2 more books, maybe after that I'll just stop. And then I think, yeah, but what would I do after that? I just can't think of, I don't know what I would do with my time.
Yeah, writers don't retire.
No, that's it. I mean, Philip Roth Roth said he's retired. And I kind of get that because he's, like I said, in his 80s now. And Alice Munro in Canada says she's retired. But and I understand that because maybe you finally feel you're written out and you're weary and you're 80 years old or whatever.
Well, what happens if you're walking down the street and you suddenly get a great idea for a book? Well, I wonder if
exactly. Exactly. But, I mean, look at James Lee Burke. James Lee Burke, I don't know his exact age, but I think if he's not 80, he's close to it.
Yeah.
And he's still turning out an astonishing novel every year. I don't know how he does it. But I guess it's a compulsion. It's just like, well, what else would I do? This is what I do.
And it must bring a certain amount of joy to it.
Yeah, it's not always joy.
It's not always joy.
Sometimes it's a lot of aggravation.
Well, it's excitement when you. It's like when you think of a great idea and it suddenly you say, oh wow, that would be great if I could just do this, and then all of a sudden everything starts to coalesce in your mind.
That's right. And you think, well, I got to write that because if I don't, somebody else will.
Exactly. And then I got to make sure nobody else steals it from me. So I.
That's right. Somebody else. If they have this idea and somebody else does it, and I could have done it, then I'll just be mad.
Do you think that happens a lot where writers will hear a plot line and try to duplicate it?
Well, I think what might happen is there might be something that happens in the news, like that we're all aware of, and someone might think, I know an angle on that, I know a way to do that as a story, and then the fear is, well, how many other authors are watching CNN thinking the same thing? And when I wrote Trust Your Eyes, the idea for that, which was kind of an updated Rear Window where someone sees a murder on Google Street View, I thought, well, that idea is so obvious, someone else is going to do it. And so I thought, I got to write that book, and I got to write it fast. And I did. And it just never occurred to anybody else.
Well, you're one of the reasons I read. I mean, your kind of books are what I love to read and what make reading exciting. And I'm talking about this trilogy in particular. Because this is the kind of stuff that I want to read. Something that's going to really grab me and really, really interest me and really make me want to get up the next day and read again. And this is what makes me happy. These kinds of books.
I do appreciate that. That's
and that's meant from the heart, and it's totally true. And I almost felt a sense of, well, what am I going to read next? It's going to be anywhere near as good as this. And it's not that there aren't some good books out there, but I don't know specifically all the time where they're going to be. You know, you can pick up a book by a great author, and it can still be a bad book. You know, it is possible.
It's true.
And you just don't know where to go next.
Yep.
I recently read a book called What She Knew by Gilly McMillan, and this book is, I think it changed my life reading it. It was just one of those books that you just could not. You literally did not want it to end at all.
I've read the second one by her, The Perfect Girl, which I thought was very well done.
Yeah, the first one's even. If you haven't read the first one, you got to go back and read the first one.
Yeah.
It's an amazing book. And it's to be able to get into the detective's mind as far as the guilt he's feeling over not finding this child is just amazing. What she did with that first book is just, you know, you can't wait to turn the pages, and yet you don't want the pages to end. You don't want it to end. You're just enjoying exactly how it's written, and you think, well, how am I ever going to find anything like this again?
Yeah, I got to read that one.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, and every once in a while you come across a real gem, and it's not always a book that everybody's read, and then the joy in telling people. I was in the Barnes & Noble like a week ago, and I was telling the woman about Broken Promise, the first one. I got her so interested, she went up the elevator just to find the first book. She couldn't wait to get it and read it. And, you know, it was amazing.
I think that's the biggest thing that sells books is word of mouth. You can see an ad in the New York Times Book Review, or whatever, and you think, okay, and you just go right past it. But it's when somebody you know says, you have to read this, that's what makes the difference.
Sometimes when a movie comes out of the book, it makes me want to read the book, too. I have this urge to want it. Well, maybe I would love to see how the book was written first before I see the movie. Sometimes I feel that way. And, you know, you never know how you're going to feel, because sometimes the movie's nowhere near as good as the book. And, you know, it could go either way. But, you know, I love to be hooked on something that's worth being hooked on. But that's the kick. Somebody ought to write a book on it. Where do you find a great book? How do you find a great book when you're not sure what to go for, you know, what to read?
Yep, true enough.
And there are just certain books that I have in my head right now that I can tell you and say, this is amazing, this is amazing. But to be able to grab the reader through three books like you did is just extraordinary. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. I'm sure it was very difficult. You said it was difficult to write the books, but I'm sure that it had to be somewhat fun to get these characters.
The tough part was just doing them back to back. That's the part that was exhausting. I mean, I think if I had done one per year, but even then, I was afraid I'd lose the thread because they were all connected, and that's another reason why I wrote.
Whatever you did, you did it great. I wouldn't have changed a thing. I would have said just do what you're doing now, except that it exhausted you. I'm sure.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Yep.
I've heard about this book, The Typewriter, that you're writing, or maybe you've already written it.
I'm working quite hard on that. I have over half a book done. I want to try to get a first draft by early December.
Does anybody even remember typewriters anymore?
Well, I know. That's the thing. That's what I love about it. It's a bit different for me. It's this book. It's about a guy who's given this antique Underwood typewriter, and he's come to believe that this was used, that this belonged to a killer who made his victims type letters of apology on it. And it's a bit different, but I think it's one of the best things
I've
done.
It sounds dark.
It's pretty dark, and it's one of the best things I've done, and it's one of those books that's kind of writing itself, you know what I mean? Like, it's going very quickly. And although I wrote so much on it, I did 4,000 words on it on Monday and 2,000 yesterday, and today I thought, you know what, I just got nothing. I'm too tired.
Really?
But I was out at an event last night, and I thought, I can't do it, I'm just beat. But it's coming together very nicely.
And they're circulating little bits about the book, and it just makes it sound so incredible. I mean, I saw the blurb, I thought, oh, wow, that does sound good. I think I'm going to have to. Now, will it be published by Berkeley next year?
No, I'm moving to a new publisher. It's going to be William Morrow who's going to do it.
Oh, really?
So I've gone to their division of HarperCollins. So I've done a three-book deal with them, and it's the first of the three.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Do you have any idea when it will be published?
I think it's going to be early 2018.
Oh,
they're
really?
Talking maybe February, March, somewhere in there.
That's a long way off, Lynn, but I don't know if I can wait that long.
Well, I don't know if I can either.
It's like cocaine. When you need cocaine, you need it, buddy.
I know. Very true.
Bad analogy. I've never taken cocaine in my life, but and neither should anybody out there that's hearing this. But
yep.
When you feel that rush, like I've got to have it. I really want to have this book, and people think that's crazy, but it isn't. I mean, it's a thrill that you get from that certain author. You can't even explain why you get it. It's just except the fact that you.
This book is an idea I had actually kind of years ago, and had been thinking at some point of doing. And at one point, I imagined it as a kind of a supernatural book, but I decided not to do it that way. I don't think it will.
I don't think that would work. You and supernatural, I don't know.
No, I know that's not what it's going to be. But it's going to be the kind of book where you're going to wonder if that's what it is. But I've got a way I think I can make it work.
Have you ever written for television?
No.
Have you ever wanted to?
When I was in my teens, that's all I wanted to do was to do that.
Why didn't you do it?
Well, you know, I was a teenager.
Doesn't mean you can't write.
But it's just the path didn't work that way. I ended up in newspapers, working in newspapers for 30 years and so forth. But when I was a teenager, that's all I wanted to do.
You were in the newspaper business for 30 years?
Yeah, I was.
And, were you happy for the 30 years?
Oh, yeah, I learned a lot. I was a columnist three times a week for 14 years at the Toronto Star, and I was an editor there for 12. And
isn't that a lot of pressure?
Well, yeah, but everything is. You know, it was a fun job. I stopped doing that. I was at the Toronto Star for 27 years. I was at a couple other papers for about four.
So. But aren't you happier now writing books?
Yeah, but I don't regret anything else I did because I think it all paved the way for what I'm doing now.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely hear what you're saying. Yeah, I just wonder with the newspaper business. The way they portray it in movies and TV, it seems like a very high pressure business.
Well, it is. It is. But
you got to write the story yesterday. You know.
Yeah. But those are all good things to learn how to do. Is how to write quickly. And so I'd spent, like I said, 30 years, and I've been out of it now for 10. And it was 10 years ago.
Do you miss it?
No. I thought it would, but I don't.
You don't at all.
I don't at all.
I don't even know what you're going to say when I ask you these questions, which is part of the fun of asking questions when you don't know the answer. You know, and do you have a book in your mind right now that you want to write, that you've always wanted to write, and you haven't written?
I think it's the one I'm doing now. I think it's the typewriter book.
It is the typewriter. Is that really going to be the final? Is it going to be called the typewriter?
I think so. I'd be surprised if we would do any other title for it. I think that's the title.
I should mention that the 23 is out from Berkeley. I don't think I mentioned them as your publisher.
Yeah.
That's the publisher. But you said Morrow's going to be your publisher for the typewriter, which
that's correct.
I can't wait to read. Now, do you even have an idea for the next book, or do you just solely focus on the typewriter to get that done? Or how does that
work? Well, there is one more Promise Falls book, and the tentative title for it is Curtain Falls. It's all written. It's done.
It's already done?
It's already finished. It'll come out next year. And
That won't be from Morrow?
No. That's going to be through my Canadian publisher. They're going to distribute that in the U.S., that one particular book, and in the U.S. So that book is done, and it's, like I say, tentatively it's called Curtain Falls because it's intended to be the final Promise Falls book.
Oh, how interesting. Now, who will be the publisher in the United States? Do you know yet?
Well, no, it's going to be Penguin Random House Canada.
Oh, okay.
They're publishing it, and they're going to distribute it. Well, it's Doubleday Canada. They're going to publish it for the U.S. as well.
Now, some of your books come out in different places, like before they come out in the United States. Is that the way it works now? Or
sometimes, although it's not usually much more than, you know, a month or 6 weeks. But sometimes the books have come out earlier in the U.K., and then sometimes the next one will come out later in the U.K. But it's usually within about 6 weeks of each other.
Did you ever dream that you'd become this successful?
No, I never. I'm still amazed.
Why? I mean, didn't you know you had some kind of talent? I mean, really, realistically?
Well, I wanted to do this from, like I said, when I was in my teens. I wanted either to be a screenwriter or a novelist, and I wanted to be the next Ross McDonald and so forth. And it just took a while. But I think there was a long period of time where I just sort of thought that wouldn't happen. I was out of my head. But I'm pleased and amazed and grateful at how things have turned out.
You really have to keep trying. That's the basic gist of anybody's life, you know, to keep going. Do something that really makes you happy. I mean, I do these interviews, they make me so happy.
Yep.
And you know, when you do something that really, and you can show your appreciation to the authors just by talking to them, it just makes you feel so good.
Yep.
And,
oh yeah, it's very true.
And I mean, you being able to do what you've always wanted to do. I mean, this is like a dream come true for you.
It is indeed, very much.
But do you ever wake up in the morning and get really frustrated because you can't think of an idea how to end a book or how to?
No, that's not usually. That usually once I'm in the thick of it, I kind of know where it's going and I know where I want to end up.
That's amazing.
So that's not usually a problem.
Lisa Scottolini was talking about a situation where she got her character into these pipes in a room somewhere, and she couldn't figure out how she was going to get the character out of them. And it's funny the way she tells the story. I mean, it's just because she couldn't not figure out what she was going to do to make this happen. And, you know, you can get yourself boxed into a corner very easily. And like, well, how am I going to get them out of this? Like Lee Child with his Jack Reacher. I mean, Jack Reacher is able to beat up 30 people at a time, you know?
Yeah, I know. But if only we could all do that.
But, you know, you just wonder, you know, how is he going to get out of this situation? I mean, and this is a recipe for disaster. And yet somehow he always manages to get out of it. He's the hero. He has to.
Yep.
And have most of your main characters been men or women?
Well, the lead characters have almost always been a man, except for a book I did called Never Saw It Coming, which didn't actually come out in book form in the U.S., but came out as a book form as an actual book in Canada and the U.K., and were bestsellers in both places. It was only an e-book in the U.S. That lead character in that is a woman.
Interesting. See, is the lead character in the typewriter a man? It sounded like it was, just for the way you described it.
Well, it's kind of half and half in that one.
Really?
Yeah, the way it's going to be a bit of both.
I kidded Lisa Scottolini actually about doing that. I mean, why don't you have men main characters? And now she does.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I want authors to change a little bit. I like the change. I like when they try something new. As long as it works. I mean, if it doesn't work. Do you always know when something is not working?
Oh, yeah. It's a little voice going back in your head saying something's wrong here. And you need to listen to that voice. If it's not working, you got to pay attention.
Well, how much is the editor helping with that, or is it all you that has to do that?
Well, I've had great editors. Every book I've done has been made better with the help of editors, you know, and I mean, sometimes the voice doesn't go off in the back of your head and you think it's working, and then you get a second set of eyes on it and they think, well, you've got a problem here. And I don't always agree, but I'd say 80% of the time I think they're right.
Do they ever, I mean, I'm wondering, with the length of the three books, and believe me, I don't care. I think they're, I loved reading every moment of every one. But I wondered if they were okay with the length of each one.
Oh, yeah. That was fine. There was no problem there.
Interesting. Because, I mean, we're definitely at an age of longer books than...
Oh, I know. I know. You look at books that the books I was reading in the 60s and the 70s are all so much shorter than the books that are out now.
In fact, I just picked up a book. I don't know how you say his name, Joe, and it's N-A-S-B-O, but it says...
Nesbo, yeah.
Nesbo, but I don't think it's pronounced Nesbo. It's got a...
Well, I think that part's right. The Joe is pronounced Yo, I think.
Yo, really?
Yeah. I did an event with him a few years ago. Nice guy.
But the thing is... You know, his books are usually 400 or 500 pages. This one was not even 200, and I'm thinking, well, how good can it be if it's only 200? If he usually is 600 pages long.
But yeah, and longer is not always better.
It really depends on the story. I think it really depends on how good the story is. As long as the story's good, it can be a complete shorter book.
Yep.
But it's all going to depend on how good that story is, how much you can draw the reader in.
It's true.
What are you really excited about reading over the next couple months? Anything that's...
Well, right now, you know what I'm reading? I've never read any of the Dark Tower stuff by Stephen King, so I've started into that. I think it's time to see what that's all about. So I'm giving that a whirl, and I've got a stack of things here that, you know, the new James Lee Burke, I've got all this stuff.
That's The Jealous Kid? Is it?
Yeah, I haven't read that yet. And so I've got a mountain of stuff, but...
But I'm curious, what about James Lee Burke really gets you? I mean, what is it about his writing?
He's just a magnificent writer. Like, I just think he's, you know, a lot of crime novels, you can kind of read them very quickly. You have to read every sentence with him. You have to give every paragraph its due, and because the writing is so fantastic. That's what I love about him.
I wonder, it sounds like one of those authors you wonder, how do they do it? How in the world can they make every sentence so beautiful?
I totally agree.
I find that about Richard Russo, too.
Oh, God, I love him. I just finished, well, I read this past summer, Everybody's Fool. God, he's so terrific.
Bridge of Sighs is what really got me into it. Is it Bridge of Sighs? It's Bridge of something.
Yeah, Bridge of Sighs. Great book.
Terrific. Something about those characters, you know, they just stick with you. And the writing is just...
Yep.
I mean, how can you explain when you like the writing of somebody why you like it? You just love it. You just love something about it. And when you can share that joy with other people, I mean, just the amount of joy you get from that.
Yeah, it's so true. David, I have something I have to head off to before too long here.
Right.
But this, I don't know if there's...
No, it's been an absolute joy to talk to you.
It's been great. It's been really a pleasure. It's been fun to talk to you, but I've got something I have to head off to shortly.
But the new book's called The 23. It's out from Berkeley Books. Make sure you read Broken Promise and Far From True, the second one. And read those two before you read the third one. But you're going to enjoy every one. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.
David, it's been a pleasure.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.